One Piece at a Time by Argosy, read by Winking Star. Rodney McKay was self-aware enough to realize that in many ways he was an open book. He was a man of shifting and varied layers. Intelligence, inventiveness, and a surprising amount of courage were all contained in his inner makeup. Mystery, however, was a quality in which he was sorely lacking. Complete strangers could usually tell exactly what he was thinking by a cursory examination of his mobile features, and if it was someone who knew Rodney, well, the game was over before it began. Which was why it was completely unfair that after nearly 4 years of living in each other's hip pockets, John Shepard could still surprise him. "So what?" Rodney asked, trying to count the boxes currently eating up valuable science space in Lab 3. "The small building on the South Pier. The one we just cleared? The one you said you were thinking about using as an auxiliary lab? What about it?" Rodney wasn't actually listening to Shepard. The Daedalus had docked that morning on its bimonthly supply run, and equipment crates were choking the already limited room in his favorite lab. It was about time the SGC started listening to him about keeping the lab stocked. A Zelenka denied his post-it notes was not something Rodney cared to ever experience again. And he had requested 3 Aeron desk chairs, 2 for him, 1 for Radek. But somebody had obviously screwed up. No way all the boxes were for him. Caldwell's grunts had probably gotten lost on the way to the armory, and he had Shepard's P90s or night goggles or something. "Are you going to use it?" Shepard was using the tone of extreme patience that usually came right before the eye tick. "Use what?" And there went the eye. For such a laid-back guy, Shepard could be wound awfully tight sometimes. Rodney tilted his head nearly upside down, trying to read the label on the largest box. "Rodney," Shepard said slowly, "is the science department planning on using the small building we cleared last week for a lab or not?" "Hmm?" Rodney couldn't quite make out the name on the slip. "No, it's too far away. Do you mind if I take it?" Rodney could probably read the name if he got down on his knees. Question: was it worth the inevitable joint pain caused by Atlantis's hard floors, or should he just have Shepard do it? "What do you want it for? You already have 3 perfectly good rooms for shooting at paper people." Shepard muttered something that sounded like personal reasons. "Little industrial for a swinging bachelor pad, don't you think?" Shepard was strangely quiet. He was embarrassed, Rodney could tell. He was twitching on the inside. Rodney considered. Science mostly ran the South Pier, which put Shepard's building under his purview. He'd had some vague notion about banishing his most annoying scientists there, but who knew what they'd get up to so far removed from his watchful eye. He didn't have the foggiest idea what Shepard could want it for, but he could be benevolent. "Knock yourself out," he said finally. "Now get down here and read the name on this box for me." "Oh," Shepard grinned. "Those are for me." He waved a hand in the direction of the most enormous crates. "Since it's not military stuff, I guess the Marines thought they should deliver them here." "Not military?" What could Shepard possibly be having shipped that took up so much space? Was he really furnishing that bachelor pad? Rodney was so lost in visions of shag carpeting and actual adult-sized beds that he almost didn't notice when Shepard patted him on the arm and pivoted away, tossing a cheery, "Thanks, buddy. I'll get this stuff out of your way later," over his shoulder. By the time he could reply that Shepard would damn well get it out of his way now, he was gone. Huh. That was odd, even for Shepard. Well, he could wonder at the vagaries of wild-haired colonels later. Right now, he needed a few of his strongest minions to move Shepard's boxes into his quarters. They would probably fit. Maybe. Shepard might not be able to use his bathroom or sleep in his bed, but Rodney was pretty okay with that. Shepard had been surprising him from the beginning. "Shoot me," Rodney had said not long after they'd met, expecting Shepard to squawk and maybe turn a little pink in that way he'd noticed he sometimes did. Instead, he'd coolly looked Rodney up and down, eyes flicking briefly to the glowing green medallion attached to his chest, and pulled his sidearm without a word. He'd had a shot off before Rodney was able to fully form the thought that this might not be such a hot idea after all. The retort was much louder than Rodney expected, which was the only reason he let out a dignified, manly shout of surprise. "You shot me!" Shepard had the nerve to look puzzled. "Isn't that what you wanted?" He had a point. Still. "You shot me!" "In the leg?" "Which is full of major arteries. What kind of person just shoots somebody with no questions asked?" "McKay." Shepard was grinning. It made him look ridiculously young. "I trust you. Any time you want to be shot, I'm happy to oblige." Shepard briefly inspected his weapon before reholstering it. He walked up close to Rodney, and hello, personal space. He'd had that almost onion thing for lunch. "And," he said, "I didn't miss." Rodney could feel his face stretching into a grin that mirrored the Major's. "No, you didn't." Shepard took a step back. Rodney realized he'd been feeling his warmth through the shield and suddenly missed it. They both smiled goofily for a moment until Shepard broke the silence. "So, Rodney, tell me about your little green friend here." Shepard had somehow gotten his crates to the South Pier, no doubt via the unauthorized usage of military personnel, and was apparently using it as some sort of workshop. The scientists had been traipsing in and out of the labs for the last few days, muttering mysteriously about aluminum skin and stubby clecos. If one more scientist reported to work with that vaguely manic gleam in his eye and the phrase "workbench jig" under his breath, Rodney was going to have to ban visits to Shepard's little playground. How did Shepard have time for hobbies, anyway? Last Rodney had checked, he was still military commander of Atlantis. It was true that the replicator threat had been mostly neutralized. The Wraith had left only busily rebuilding pockets of resistance. And the Wraith themselves were reeling from the replicator wars. Still, hobbies? Rodney's own very important job didn't leave him any time for cross-stitch or badminton. Work was a perfectly good leisure activity. He still didn't know what Shepard was building over there. He was curious, but Simpson had come to him with a star 10 light-years away that was exhibiting anomalous behavior, and Carter had found a list of possible ZPM addresses in the ancient database. Raddick had submitted yet another in his long line of harebrained proposals to study quantum entanglement, of all things. So Rodney had a lot on his plate, and Shepard's latest weirdness would have to wait. What would a man like him want to build, anyway? He was probably trying to reverse-engineer a DeLorean. Or a lightsaber. That would be cool. Who knew Shepard was so do-it-yourself, anyway? If he was the kind of man that required his own workshop, he should have been in the trenches getting his hands dirty during any one of the 1,000 times their plumbing had failed. If Rodney did go to see Shepard's project and discovered he knew his way around a distributor wrench, he was not getting out of Tuesday night puddle jumper maintenance. Shepard should have been happy. He had his workshop, he had his mysterious project, and he had a mostly over war when he felt like shooting things. So there was no reason for him to give Rodney the puppy dog eyes over breakfast one morning and whine about how it had been 3 weeks and Rodney still hadn't been to his workshop. Rodney had rolled his eyes and taken the path of least resistance, and, after a long trek to the end of the pier, which was not near any transporters, and during which walk Rodney had restrained himself from making any comments about how it was a shame the pier wasn't shorter so that Shepard could take a long walk off of it, here they were. The building was an oddity for Atlantis, a one-story stout square box, not beautiful in any way. The anthropologists had made some attempts to explain what the ancients had used it for, but really, who cared? It had been checked out and declared free of any surprises, nasty or helpful. It had two huge doors and was slightly bigger than a three-car garage on the inside, with a skylight and not much else. Except not anymore. Now Shepard had set up a workbench on one side of the room, which was covered in small tools. Rodney recognized fluting pliers, a Vixen file, and a rivet gun amongst them. "That's not good organization," he heard himself saying. All his attention was sucked elsewhere in the room, but his mouth seemed to go on autopilot. "You need a pegboard. With outlines." He still couldn't quite catch his mouth up to his brain, and even his brain seemed frozen in place, unable to compute. Because Shepard had set up some kind of rigging fixture, shoulder high and about 30 feet long with jigs mounted to each end. A long metal spar was braced between the jigs, and on the floor in front of that were other metal spars, and what were clearly ribs with big round cutouts. Metal sheets lay ready on the other side of the room. Rodney was not an expert, but he was an engineer, and it was so incredible he could barely get the words out. His voice cracked with the effort. "You're building an airplane." Shepard's grin was so wide Rodney couldn't believe it still fit on his face. "Yep." But he had to sit. There, Shepard had a chair over there. "But..." Deep breaths. "Try again." "But you have spaceships!" Shepard surprised him yet again by managing to make his grin even wider. The corners of his mouth would meet in the back soon. "Yep." He didn't seem to be getting it. "Why would you want an airplane when you have spaceships?" Shepard shrugged, still with that giddy look on his face. "Not the same thing." "Okay." He could understand that. Sort of. Okay, not at all. But he could see how Shepard, the freak, could think that way. "But why build one? I understand they come ready-made." Shepard actually laughed. "I had enough trouble getting the cargo allotment for the kit pieces. This is just the wing. Besides..." He was suddenly looming over Rodney and leaning in conspiratorially, which was ridiculous because they were the only two people there. "I always wanted to build a plane. Want to help?" For a moment, it was tempting. The engineering. But then sanity prevailed. "No, I'm much too busy with actual work, work that may save our lives, to play toy airplanes with you." Shepard's face fell, but the grin snuck back almost immediately. Rodney had the distinct feeling Shepard had not taken his refusal seriously. "Suit yourself. My door's always open if you change your mind." He turned to his rigging and began fiddling cheerfully with something Rodney couldn't see. In fact, the doors to Shepard's workshop were made out of an ancient alloy and were far too heavy to actually remain standing open. But Rodney took his point. The people of MXG-641 had an alien princess they wanted Shepard to marry before they would cement a trade agreement with the Lantians. It was nothing they hadn't been through a dozen times before. Strictly ceremonial with no strings attached. Hold hands with a pretty girl in the town square, get a garland of flowers and a shiny new ally, and congratulate yourselves on a job well done. Few cultures in the Pegasus Galaxy took these ceremonial marriages seriously, and Taylor assured them that the Frolians were not among them. Plus, there was usually some kind of feast to be had at the end of these things, and Rodney had been smelling a scent that was remarkably like freshly baked chocolate chip muffins all throughout the negotiations. So he was naturally taken aback when Shepard refused to marry the girl. The Frolians got very tight around their mouths, and Taylor pulled the team back for a private consultation in the corner. "I do not understand," she began. "What's wrong with her?" Rodney was not hissing. You couldn't hiss words without an S. "Never mind. Nothing's wrong with her. And even if there was, you never have to see her after today. Did you smell the chocolate?" "The Frolians have agreed to a very generous arrangement, John. We will be glad of the Tika grain come winter." And oh God, Shepard had on his stubborn face. I just think we should start thinking about these things more. Maybe we shouldn't take marriage so lightly. He looked at Rodney with a peculiarly intense expression on his face, like there was something he wanted Rodney to understand. But chocolate? And why had Shepard picked today to be weirder than usual? He had two ceremonial wives that Rodney knew of, and one ceremonial husband, and he'd never balked before. And, oh God. You're involved with someone on Atlantis, aren't you? Who? And why didn't you tell me? I'm sure the lithe young marine biologist of the moment won't mind. We don't even have to tell her. I'm not seeing anyone, Rodney. Shepard's whole body went stiff. In their corner, the Frolians were making increasingly loud, unhappy noises. You are! Rodney peered closely at Shepard's face. Oh my God, you're in love! He couldn't believe Shepard hadn't told him. He wasn't entirely emotionally backwards. He could be happy for him. Rodney. Wow. Shepard could say a lot with one word. Shut up. Okay, that was three words. He started anyway, but stopped at the sight of Shepard violently scrubbing his hands through his hair. In the end, Shepard agreed to marry the princess, but the Frolians decided that as representative of the fallen planet of Setida, Ronan would do just as well. So Ronan got a flower wreath around his head and a demure kiss from a pretty girl, and the largest piece of chocolate cake. Shepard got his dignity, and what was that worth when weighed against chocolate cake? Rodney got cake too, and another piece of the puzzle that was Shepard, and damned if he had any idea where it fit. Shepard's love affair with the marine biologist, anthropologist, doctor, Keller, must have ended quickly, because Rodney didn't hear any more about it. The wings were proceeding. The main spar had gotten crosswise ribs attached that diminished in size as they approached the tips. The shape of the thing was clear now, and damned if Shepard wasn't putting together an airplane. And, in what was just another oddity in the parade of surprises that made up Shepard, he was doing it alone. Rodney knew for a fact that he'd had no shortage of offers of help. The engineers were salivating at the idea of building a kit plane, as were some of the more mechanically inclined marines, and, surprisingly, a few of the botanists. Shepard would just smile in that little boy way he had, thank the person for wanting to help, and explain that he wanted to do it on his own for now, that there was something kind of special going on between him and the plane that he didn't want to disturb. Instead of laughing in his face, the engineer, or marine, or botanist would go away feeling charmed and somehow special. Rodney would never understand how Shepard did that. It turned out Rodney did need a hobby after all, because he had discovered the most relaxing, yet oddly compelling, pastime ever was bringing a laptop to Shepard's workshop after missions and during free moments. He'd watch him work and add commentary when he felt it necessary. Like now. You're not going to attach the top forward skins without doing a leak test of the auxiliary fuel tanks, are you? Shepard, who so was, made a little snort of disbelief. Of course not. You'll need an access hole at the bottom of each wet bay. You don't need to make them nearly as large as these blueprints say. Huh. Shepard joined him at the workbench. He leaned in close to look over the plans. His head was nearly touching Rodney's. Rodney was really going to have that talk with him about personal space. I think you're right. Of course I'm right. I do have a doctorate in mechanical engineering. And yet you won't get your ass out of the peanut gallery to help. Which was another thing that surprised Rodney. Apparently he wouldn't disturb whatever this thing was that Shepard had going with the plane. The colonel seemed glad of his company and eager for his help. Of course Rodney was a damned fine engineer, but Dr. Esposito had offered her services, and she wasn't half bad, and hot besides. But these nights when they could get away to the workshop were mostly just him and Shepard. Rodney felt weirdly touched, and half inclined to make a clubhouse sign. The junior member of the club was Ronan, of all people. He'd wandered in one day and fallen hard for the Taylor 5X rivet gun. Now he showed up occasionally, seeming to have a sixth sense for when there was riveting afoot. When Rodney had asked why he was allowed to play, and the scientists were turned away, Shepard had shrugged and asked if Rodney wanted to tell Ronan he wasn't allowed to work on the plane. Besides, he was a monster with a rivet gun. Rodney took to calling him Rosie, which didn't bother him at all, even when he discovered the reference. They were cool, he informed Rodney, who had to agree that yes, they were. When Shepard's plane grew up, it was going to be an 80% scale model of a World War II P-51 Mustang, with a wingspan of 27 feet and a cruising speed of around 300 miles an hour. It would carry 140 gallons of 92-octane gas fully loaded and be 22.5 feet long. It would take years to build. You know, I could hack the SGC system to get you a bigger cargo allotment on the Daedalus. We could get you a Cessna or a Cub. No assembly required. Thanks, Rodney. And there was the grin of Shepard's that never came out in public. The one that was completely genuine, without the slightest effort to charm. I'm good. So, you feel like working yet? I've got a hand seamer with your name on it. Rodney didn't feel that deserved an answer. When Rodney was working on his second doctorate, astrophysics, he'd decided to do mechanical engineering first, for practice. He had never considered that his chosen career path would lead to him spending quite so much time in prison. As jails went, PF-8-472s wasn't too bad. They'd been provided with a dark brown bread and enough water, and their captors were strictly after a ransom, so no unpleasant torture. Always a plus. The dirt floor left something to be desired, however, and there was no furniture at all, which left them sprawling on the cell floor while they waited for Atlantis to negotiate their release. Ronan had assessed the threat, minimal, then scraped up a little dirt nest for himself and promptly fallen asleep, snoring a little. Shepard, Taylor, and Rodney were left to come up with their own entertainment. After a vigorous round of 20 questions, and Fermat numbers were not animal, thank you very much, Shepard, and the tournament of staring, Taylor 1, Shepard 3, Rodney 6. Ha! They'd settled into one of their comfortable discussions about Star Wars. It was a thing he and Shepard had when they were tired or bored or imprisoned, and so familiar Rodney barely had to pay attention. In the last 4 years, they'd hashed out the origins of sand people, genetic manipulation gone wrong, the deep symbolism of colored lightsabers. Rodney maintained that in the real world they would all be white. And Leia's best outfit, aside from the gold bikini, the little snow bunny number from Hoth, amongst other things. Rodney knew Shepard's thoughts on the trilogy from the opening crawl to the ending bonfire, so he did not just hear Shepard say what he thought he had. No, Rodney said, utterly calm with conviction. You like Han Solo best. Luke. Shepard's mouth had taken a firm, not entirely friendly cast. No, Rodney couldn't believe what he was hearing. No, pi is 3.14159 and so on. A body in motion tends to stay in motion. There's never enough grape juice, but always far too much orange, and John Shepard likes Han Solo better than Luke Skywalker. Rodney, is this really the time? You're disintegrating my worldview. When's a good time for that? Han Solo was a pilot. He had rakish hair. He was cool. Luke was a pilot, too, and he could bullseye womp rats from a speeder. That's pretty cool. But he wanted to get out, but he knew his aunt and uncle needed him on the farm. Shepard's voice got quieter. Luke was the kind of guy who would sacrifice his own dreams to do right by his people. I admire that. Oh. Oh. Rodney felt a little like he'd been punched in the gut. They stared in silence a moment until Taylor suddenly spoke up. I like Princess Leia, she said. Princess Leia's for girls, they both replied automatically. Taylor got very still and seemed to grow taller, though she remained seated. Her voice was icy. I hope that when my daughter is born, you will keep your gender-based Earth stereotypes to yourselves. Okay, and... Huh? Rodney stared at her. It seemed Shepard wasn't the only person who could surprise him. He knew his jaw had dropped open, and that was the only thing that was keeping him from saying something he would regret for the rest of his life. And oh God, Shepard's voice was still working. You're pregnant? I thought you were just getting fat. And really, physical shock was the only thing that could make Shepard say something like that. And maybe Taylor would forgive him after she'd beaten him up a few dozen times. Then again, maybe she wouldn't. Just then, their wonderful, fantastic captors appeared with the news that the ransom of antibiotics and MREs had arrived, and they were free to go. Rodney had always hated going along with the crowd, but it seemed he was as powerless to resist John Shepard as everyone else. He'd fallen into a regular habit of working on Shepard's plane with him before he'd really even noticed. And okay, it was actually kind of fun. It was good to feel Earth tools in his hands again. The ancient ones were all far too elegant and tapered in weird places. He found he enjoyed finishing up a long day at the lab and coming by the workshop to trim sheet metal or drill burr holes. They were just finishing up the landing gear and could then declare the wings done. Rodney had spent the better part of 2 evenings mounting the wheels and brakes to the strut assembly, and there was no way around it. He was going to have to trim the inboard ends of the axles so that the brake discs would fit into the calipers. That would eat up another night. When he complained to Shepard about it, all he got was a sideways grin, followed by a sage nod. "Atlantis wasn't built in a day, Rodney," he said in a knowing tone of voice. Rodney was tempted to take his hacksaw and go home. The truth was, Rodney didn't quite trust Shepard to put the plane together on his own. The man had proved himself surprisingly capable of it, but Rodney wasn't completely convinced that Shepard remembered that he was going to be flying this thing, too. "Yes, Mom," Shepard would say every time Rodney broached the subject. But a moment later, he would always look into Rodney's worried eyes and say, "I'll be safe, Rodney. Really. I'm building it completely to spec." He wasn't cutting corners. He was building the machine responsibly and with care. It would be as safe as any small plane, which was to say, not nearly safe enough for Rodney's taste. He felt a little better being there to keep an eye on things, a little more sure that this bucket of riveted sheet metal would keep Shepard from harm. It wasn't just superstition. Rodney had made several safety modifications to the blueprints. He needed to remember to send those to the manufacturer in the next data burst. Every time he would tell Shepard about one of his changes, Shepard would get a strange look on his face. His eyes would go all funny, and he would stare at Rodney with one side of his mouth curling up. "What?" Rodney would ask irritably. "I'm just trying to keep you from killing yourself." At this, Shepard would invariably laugh and squeeze Rodney's shoulder. "Wouldn't want that," he would say in a fond tone of voice. Once he even ruffled Rodney's hair. There had been a time Rodney had thought he might someday understand Shepard, but it looked like he might as well give up on that and concentrate on something easier, like M-theory. Only Rodney had never been able to let go of a puzzle. Almost every night he would ask some variation of why an airplane, when Shepard had a whole fleet of perfectly good spaceships that could, you know, go through space. Tonight, as he was clearing the welds on the torque plate, he said, "The jumpers are going to be jealous. They'll think you're cheating on them." Shepard heard the real question, like he always did. He seemed to never tire of answering it, though the answers always varied. In a little plane, you can feel every bump in the wind. He leaned across Rodney for a number 3 Cleco, and then took his time choosing the one he wanted. Rodney could feel his solid weight pushing into his side. Shepard was always warm. "And that's a good thing?" He tried to make his voice skeptical, but he felt a sudden need to swallow. Shepard seemed to think that was an answer. He finally picked out a handful of Clecos and straightened. "It's amazing. When you're taking off, you feel the wind pushing under the wings, lifting you up. These small planes, they just want to fly. You can barely keep them on the ground." There was something about Shepard when he talked about planes, something in his eyes and voice that wasn't there even when he talked about the jumpers or Atlantis, and Rodney liked listening to him for some reason he couldn't define. Without a headset, all you can hear is the engine, and you can feel it rumbling all through the plane and all through you. You can feel everything. Rodney let Shepard talk on about how inertial dampeners were the best thing since toast, but they made flying the jumpers feel like flying a simulator. About how the canopy was nothing like a view screen. About how when you were up in a small plane, you really knew you were up in the sky. He listened to stories about how Shepard learned to fly by getting an after-school job at a small airfield. About the crashes Shepard had been in. 3, but only one where he was the pilot. About instrument flying, which was both utterly amazing and an enormous pain in the ass. He let Shepard talk until he was talked out, which didn't happen for almost 2 hours. When Shepard finished, he sort of shook himself and looked around. Rodney expected him to make some kind of comment about how this must be the longest time Rodney had ever gone without speaking. But instead, Shepard turned a brilliant smile on him, touched his shoulder, and they walked the long walk back to the living quarters in silence. Tayla's special friend, Kanan, was surprised to find he had a 5-month-old daughter when the Athosians finally returned from the parallel universe they'd accidentally gotten themselves stuck in. The Athosians hadn't even realized anything was wrong until Jinto, who was apparently the Athosian Columbo, noticed that Tayla had suddenly become left-handed. He put 2 and 2.5 together, came up with parallel universe, and managed to contact that universe's Rodney McKay, thus proving himself sharper than approximately 63% of Atlantis' scientists. Rodney would have to speak to Sam about getting Jinto taken on as a lab assistant. Rodney and alternate Rodney did some cross-dimensional physics, and everyone was back where they belonged. No one was happier to have the Athosians back than Shepard, who figured that with little Jara's daddy back, his babysitting duties would be over. Alas, it was not to be, as Tayla and Kanan needed a lot of alone time to reconnect. They spent at least one night a week on the mainland, where the Athosians had relocated while they scouted a good planet for New Athos. New Athos having turned out to be riddled with dimensional rifts that could lead to one finding one's unsuspecting self sucked into a parallel universe. Rodney had never thought about it, but if he had, he would have assumed that Shepard would be great with babies. The beings, humans, aliens, ancients, who were not immediately charmed upon meeting him, were preciously few and far between, so why would small people be any different? The Colonel, however, turned out to be terrified of babies. "They're so small," he would whisper to Rodney. "And they have tiny fingernails and soft places on their heads." Tayla, who could hold a grudge much longer than Rodney would have given her credit for, had made Shepard Jara's Rahela, which turned out to be less godfather than official babysitter. After his first 20 minutes with the baby, Shepard had barged through Rodney's door with a wild look in his eyes, begging Rodney not to make him do this alone. Jara turned out to be a much easier baby than Jeannie ever was, so Rodney didn't mind helping out when he could. It was a kick to see those big brown eyes stare solemnly up at him, and to feel her little hand grip his finger. He assumed that Shepard would overcome his fear given enough exposure, but it didn't happen. Seeing an Air Force colonel reduced to hysterics by a 10-pound ball of fluff never got old. On a typical night of minding the baby, Rodney would finish feeding Jara and hand her over to Shepard, who, no matter how many times they did this, would stiffen and cradle her like she was a hand grenade with the pin out. Jara, for her part, would remain calm for a differing amount of time each night. If Rodney didn't know better, he would swear she had some kind of built-in random number generator, before erupting in blood-curdling wails. Shepard always looked miserable, but he only dropped her the first few times, and never on her head. Sometimes Jara would let Shepard hold her for 5 whole minutes before screaming or spitting up, or once, memorably, peeing in his face, which Rodney wouldn't have thought was possible for a girl. Shepard would start to relax a little bit and shoot Rodney a look of burgeoning hope and confidence, and Jara would let him have it right on cue. Shepard would blanch, convinced he'd broken her, and shove her into Rodney's arms, where she would promptly stop crying or spitting and settle down with a contented gurgle. Privately, Rodney was convinced Jara was messing with Shepard. He was secretly proud, only a few months old and already an expert in the art of shepherd baiting. Jara's future looked bright. He wondered how Taylor would feel about sending her to Earth for college. The best part of these evenings, though, was always after Jara had gone to sleep in the little painted Athosian crib shepherd Azrahela kept in his room. In the beginning, Rodney had tried to leave after Jara settled down, sure that even Shepherd couldn't be scared of a sleeping baby. But the first night the baby sat together, Shepherd pulled out a copy of the director's cut of Blade Runner once Jara went to sleep. The next time, The Wrath of Khan, and the time after that, his chessboard. Eventually, Rodney got the hint and stopped trying to go. Now, when Jara started making her little baby sleeping noises, they'd settle in to watch a movie, or play chess, or talk about the work the plane needed, quietly so as not to wake her, until Taylor arrived to take her home. Building the Mustang's fuselage was exponentially more difficult than the wings for several reasons. For one thing, most of the plane's systems went through there, and also it was far less straightforward in terms of trimming and fitting, especially the cowling and cockpit. Rodney decided they should work fore to aft on the top portion of the fuselage above the scoop, then turn it upside down and fit in the tail wheel hydraulics. Shepard looked amused at Rodney's decree, but clearly Rodney was right, so there was no argument. It didn't take long to build the proper jig to hold the fuselage level. Putting the skeleton together was relatively easy, and the forward fuselage skins took another couple of weeks after that. Shepard got a little pissy when Rodney rejected the first pair of cockpit seats and made him send away to Earth for two more. He graciously admitted he had been wrong when the new seats arrived, and Rodney magnanimously accepted his apology. They spent an evening just lounging in them and watching a DVD on Rodney's laptop. All in all, Rodney couldn't believe how much fun he was having with Shepard's plane, and with Shepard, for that matter. They usually worked well together in the field, but working on a project in their spare time was different somehow. He'd never been on a team as a kid. He supposed this was something like that, though he couldn't tell which one of them was the captain. Probably Shepard, since it was his plane after all. Captain or not, Shepard was still the weirdest man in two galaxies. They'd installed the rudder cables and the aileron controls and had worked their way up to the engine mount, and the whole time Shepard kept touching him. At first, Rodney hadn't really noticed. Shepard had always seemed to touch him a lot. A guiding hand to the back on a mission, a tug on his tack vest when he wanted him somewhere quickly, a smack on the back of the head when he got annoyed. Seriously, what grown man does that? So at first, when Shepard would lean across him to grab a metal snipper, or balance himself with a hand on Rodney's shoulder to adjust a screw high on the fuselage, Rodney wrote it off as general shepherdness and didn't think any more about it. But he kept doing it, greeting his arrival with a shoulder squeeze, punching him on the arm as a goodbye. It got to the point where Rodney felt the phantom press of Shepard's fingertips long after he'd returned to his quarters. He was always surprised there weren't any bruises. One night, after Rodney wrenched his side, removing a stubborn bolt, Shepard actually started massaging his shoulders. Rodney almost wrenched his other side in his haste to jump away. Shepard looked puzzled, and there would never be a better time than now for that personal space talk Rodney had been meaning to have for months, maybe years. He opened his mouth to speak, and unexpectedly found himself utterly without words. "Rodney?" asked Shepard. He'd meant to say something like, "Stop touching me so much," or, "Do you have some kind of tactile compulsion I should know about?" Or even, "Why don't you touch anyone else as much as you touch me?" Instead, he just shrugged a little, then winced as it tugged at his ribs. "Hurts," he said, and wasn't that eloquent. Shepard smiled softly and began massaging his shoulders again, and Rodney couldn't really find any reason for him not to. In the relatively short time Rodney had known him, John Shepard had been a bug and an old man. He'd been possessed by a homicidal alien and had lived 6 months while the rest of Atlantis had only lost an hour. He'd haunted his friend's nightmares, and he'd lost his memories to the Pegasus version of chickenpox. So Rodney supposed he shouldn't be surprised that Shepard was taking this all in stride. For Shepard, this was probably a blip on the radar that was life in the Pegasus galaxy. Hell, compared to other things that regularly happened to him, this was probably a vacation. But did he have to be so relaxed about the whole thing? Couldn't he freak out like a normal person? Shouldn't he be hiding in his quarters instead of out there in the corridor for everyone to see? And for God's sake, can't you stop walking like that? Rodney thought he sounded remarkably calm under the circumstances. Like what? Shepard asked, and the ridiculous thing was that he wasn't faking that tone of innocence. Like that, with the hips and the sashaying. This is how I always walk, Rodney. It was the infuriating truth. Shepard had loose limbs and slinky hips, and nothing had changed now just because he was a girl. Shepard shot him a crooked smile. It looked ludicrously appealing on his softer features. Curse all ancient tech. And curse all ancients with their dangerous lack of concern for labeling things. Rodney was going to move back to Earth and design roller coasters or something. It had been an ascension machine, of course, different from the one that had tried to eat Rodney. And what was with the ancients and all the rampant cheating? Do the work yourself or stay corporeal. The entry in the database, and for once Rodney would like to find one of those entries before the tragic accident, said that the device Shepard had accidentally activated let the wannabe ascender walk a mile in someone else's shoes. The actual idiom was something like swimming in another's bathing dress, which, ew. The apparent logic behind this was the idea that experiencing the hurdles of others would put you in a more enlightened frame of mind. The database entry also said that the effects would only last 2 weeks, so no one was panicking, especially not Shepard, which Rodney did not get at all. If it had been him, he would have been crawling the walls or maybe hurling bricks at all the pretty stained glass. At the very least, he would have had every scientist on the beast searching for some way to reverse the process. All Shepard had done was have a little powwow with Sam and Keller, wherein they decided to take a wait-and-see attitude for the 2 weeks, and gone about his business. It was patently idiotic. When the ancients said 2 weeks, they were perfectly capable of meaning metaphorical weeks which could last months or years. Rodney would have been spending all his time in the lab trying to come up with a solution himself if he hadn't felt it necessary to stay within arm's distance of Shepard to keep people from looking at him with their grubby little eyes. "I'm fine, Rodney," Shepard had said in a higher voice. "The only person treating me differently is you." Which may only have been Shepard's naive perception, but also, Rodney hated to admit it, may have been the truth. Shepard had adapted surprisingly well to being a woman, and the rest of Atlantis had followed suit. It probably helped that he didn't look much different. He was still long and lean, with a pointed face and unruly hair. The device had made him a little less hairy, and given him slightly rounder features and pert little breasts, which was something Rodney had never, ever wanted to associate with John Shepard, and now he had to go bleach his brain. With Shepard dressed in his standard black BDUs, you almost didn't notice the change. When Rodney asked, as he did approximately once an hour, why Shepard wasn't terrified, or angry, or an incoherent puddle of goo like a rational person would be, Shepard just shrugged and said it was kind of interesting seeing things from the other side. Rodney knew what that meant. That meant nights in the dark in his quarters exploring his new female perspective and female parts. And oh god, bleach was not going to be enough. At least some things hadn't changed. Shepard as a woman was just as terrible with Jara as he had been as a man. That meant something. Rodney didn't know what, but it was strangely comforting. During the days, Shepard stuck to his routine. He trained with the Marines and sparred with Tayla and did whatever else he did, which, judging by Rodney's close observation of the last week, was spider solitaire, hanging out in Rodney's lab, and working on the Mustang. And he invited Rodney to his quarters for dinner, which was new. "What?" Rodney had said intelligently. Shepard had rolled his eyes. "You're spending all your time breathing down my neck anyway." thought this would make it easier. So now they were in Shepard's quarters, seated at Shepard's really, really small table. Shepard had brought two trays of the chicken thing they were serving in the mess, and had found a bottle of wine somewhere, and oh god, he smelled kind of good. "You okay, buddy?" Shepard placed a hand on his arm. He hadn't stopped all the touching, even though he was now a female. With female parts, Rodney's brain supplied helpfully. Shepard didn't mean anything by it. He was just acting the way he always had. His hand was a bit smaller, though still gun-calloused, and so warm. Rodney stared at it like it might detach itself any minute and leap for his throat. He tried to will himself to see Shepard the way he had looked a week ago. He wasn't all that different. Still the same colonel, just a slightly different package. Or no package. Rodney giggled, possibly a bit hysterically. Shepard was looking at him with genuine concern now. "Rodney?" "I'm fine," Rodney managed to choke out. Shepard's face relaxed slightly. That was better. He was so pretty. But then he'd always been pretty. Wait, what? Shepard's hand was still on his arm, making him have very wrong thoughts about his only temporarily female best friend. But maybe Shepard would want to try out his temporarily female new body? The thought slammed him in the gut. Maybe Shepard had already tried it out. Rodney jumped up, barely managing not to upset the table. "Go," he said. "That is me. I need to go. Simulation. Very important." He had to get out of there now. Had to be somewhere, anywhere, far from Shepard's feminine side. "Okay," said Shepard, looking disappointed. "Right," said Rodney. "Simulation. I'll just be..." "You do that," Shepard nodded. "Right," said Rodney. "Okay," said Shepard. Rodney fled, not stopping until he was back in his room. He was not freaking out. Shepard had not asked him on a date. He was not behaving any differently than he usually did. It was Rodney's treacherous brain that had put that spin on his perfectly innocent actions. He and Shepard didn't think that way about each other. And even if Rodney had ever had any fleeting, insignificant, not even really there, thoughts in that direction, Shepard certainly hadn't. Shepard was just being Shepard. Rodney could do this. Shepard would be a man again soon, and then everything would go back to normal. In the meantime, he could control his wayward brain. He'd not thought about Shepard in the past. He could continue not thinking about him in the future. He sat down on the bed, where he took deep breaths and spent some time not thinking about girl Shepard twice, and original Shepard once. These thoughts absolutely did not occur with his hand on his dick. Everything was in place to start assembling the Mustang's engine. Since Rodney wanted to add in a supercharger, they'd decided to go for a lighter weight aluminum block, rather than the heavier iron one, along with forged pistons and a roller cam. They were going to use a Bendix-style fuel system and a dry sump, and drive the accessories from a belt rather than pads. Rodney had been looking forward to putting it together for months. "Get some free time tonight, buddy?" Shepard waggled his completely male eyebrows at him. Rodney nearly choked on the Ethosian equivalent of Cheerios. They were little rocks. He was sure of it. "Actually, I've got something important going at the lab tonight. You know." He forced himself to swallow the last pebble. "Saving lives and whatnot." "Okay." Shepard looked puzzled. "Tomorrow?" Sure. He made himself smile. "If I can. The experiment might have to run all week." "Oh." Shepard looked like he wanted to say more. "But don't let that stop you," Rodney added quickly. "Okay," Shepard said, still with that strange look. "I won't." Shepard asked him three more times before he started building the engine by himself. Rodney knew when he began because Ronan, who was finishing the last of the riveting on the plane's body, seemed to feel the need to keep Rodney up to date. Ronan had been disappointed to learn that the engine needed no rivets, but he was philosophical. The wings still needed to be attached to the body, and Shepard had promised him he could keep the gun once the plane was built. Rodney had visions of wraith skulls riveted to the walls of Atlantis. Ronan never mentioned the fact that Rodney had stopped coming to the workshop, only looked at him quizzically every once in a while as he related Shepard's struggles with the coolant system in a surprisingly knowledgeable manner. Shepard treated him the same as always, which Rodney hadn't expected. He didn't seem angry with him, or disappointed. They went on missions and ate together in the mess when Rodney didn't see him coming first. He never talked about the Mustang, except when someone, Sam usually, sometimes Keller, asked him specifically, and then he always said it was coming along fine. Rodney knew exactly how it was coming along, because once a week or so he ventured down to the workshop after he was sure Shepard was asleep in his quarters. He needed to check Ronan's riveting and assure himself that Shepard was putting together an engine that wouldn't burst into flames when he tried to take it in the air. Rodney didn't expect to make any changes, and he didn't. Shepard's work was always good. He was glad of that. He didn't know what he would say if Shepard discovered his late-night visits. Shepard probably thought he was still freaking out over the whole female thing. Rodney let him because the truth was so much worse. The fact was Shepard's adventures and gender fluidity hadn't changed anything in Rodney's thinking. He'd always thought about Shepard, he realized now, with a kind of intensity that he never directed at anyone else. Shepard was the person Rodney wanted to share a discovery with, the person he wanted in the infirmary if he got hurt. It was all too much, and how had it happened? Shepard, somehow, had fit himself into parts of Rodney that Rodney hadn't even known were empty. He was in danger of letting Shepard become everything. Did he want that? Well, it hardly mattered what Rodney wanted, because he was sure Shepard didn't. Sure he'd be horrified by Rodney's messy attachment. He almost didn't notice it, because he'd been spending so much of his non-mission time avoiding Shepard, and since he'd been successful at it, he knew that Shepard had been avoiding him back. If he hadn't been so hypersensitive to Shepard's every move lately, it would have been an easy thing to miss. Shepard had stopped touching him. The hand on his back, the pats to his shoulder, these were all gone. Well, that made it easier then, and gave Rodney his answer, even though he'd already known. He guessed he wouldn't have to have that talk with Shepard about personal space after all. One thing that had never surprised Rodney about Shepard was how many people wanted him. Alien priestesses and shy anthropologists, sure, but beyond that, Genai warlords and high chiefs who had discovered he could wake their ancient ruins. Dying civilizations that needed his genes for repopulation, and angry villagers who'd heard the rumor that he was the man who had woken the Wraith. So when Shepard was captured on MH7 9G2 and spirited away to God knew where, Rodney could honestly say that one thing he did not feel was surprise. It had been 3 months, 93 days, since he'd been taken, and nearly that long since Rodney had slept. Fall had changed to a mild winter, Jara had 3 teeth with a 4th on the way, and Lorne had proven himself as military commander in more than one skirmish. Sam had already scaled back the search once. She wanted to do it again, Rodney could tell. He could see it in her eyes at every staff meeting. But she couldn't say it to Rodney's face. Rodney was sure he could somehow convince Shepard's malfunctioning subcutaneous transmitter to come back online. He knew he could boost the signal enough so that they could receive it if he could just keep working, if he could just try harder. Keller wouldn't give him any more stimulants, but that was all right. He didn't need them to stay functional. The goal was enough. On the 97th day, Atlantis's gate activated with no IDC. 40 seconds later, Shepard limped through under his own power, collapsed, and didn't wake up for 2 weeks. He'd been beaten, badly and repeatedly. Purple bruises scattered across yellowish healing ones on his face and arms, and most of his torso. His lower lip was split and raw, and 3 teeth were missing. Shallow red tracks were spaced evenly along his thighs, where his legs had been cut systematically with something sharp. He had 5 cracked ribs and a complex concussion, and his fingers had all been broken more than once, save the left pinky for some reason. Several had healed badly. His left ankle had been fractured, then badly set, and was beginning to turn black with gangrene. He was covered with blood, drenched in it, and none of it was his. Rodney turned straight around after they'd gotten Shepard safely to the infirmary. Taylor found him 50 minutes later in the armory, gathering enough C4 to take out a hive ship, and spoke to him quietly until he could breathe again. 14 days later, Shepard was awake and coherent for almost 3 minutes. When Lorne, who had been waiting, asked for a direction in which to point the Marines, Shepard spoke for the first time. "There's no one left, Major," he said. After that, Shepard was in and out of consciousness for a week. He could usually be counted on to wake around noon, when he was given new meds, and Rodney tried to make sure he was there during those times. He could tell Keller thought it was odd that he left the infirmary at all. On other occasions when Shepard had been hurt, Rodney had set up a workspace the next bed over, but this time there was somewhere else he had to be. He felt a little bad the next week, when Shepard had woken up enough to wonder at Rodney's absences. But Shepard was still so loopy on pain medication that Rodney thought it probably didn't bother him that much. The week after that, Shepard was bored and hurting and kind of lonely, even though Taylor and Jara were nearly always at his bedside. Jara was even being friendly to him, though Rodney saw Shepard flinch away from her baby fists during the times he was able to visit. "Are you mad at me?" Shepard asked, his voice still raw. "What? No." "'Cause you were acting kind of mad at me. You know, before." Shepard reached out a hand. It was shaking slightly. Rodney could feel something unclench in his stomach as he took it. Shepard was even warmer than usual. Fever, Rodney thought vaguely, worriedly. But his grip was strong, and Rodney held on tight. Shepard started physical therapy the week after that, so at least he wasn't bored anymore. He slept a lot, tired out from the exercises. He seemed to understand when Rodney said that he wanted to be there more, but he was working on something really important. "Same old Rodney," he'd say sometimes, with a sad little grin, and then Rodney had to blow everything off for that day and sit there with Shepard and play cards or talk about superheroes. Or just watch him sleep. 5 weeks later, Shepard was well enough to be released from the infirmary, though not well enough for full duty. He spent most of the time asleep in his room, but he seemed to like it when Rodney was there. Rodney started working nights. When Shepard could walk by himself for 15 minutes without breathing heavily or wincing in pain, Rodney took him out to the South Pier. They walked along the left side, which they usually didn't. If Shepard thought it was odd, he didn't say anything. Eventually, they reached the workshop. This was it, then. "I just want to say," Rodney began. No, that was wrong. Shepard looked at him quizzically. "Rodney?" he asked, when he remained silent. "Look," Rodney said finally. "I didn't know if I should do this, but I couldn't think of anything else I could do. For you. If you hate it, we can take it apart. I wasn't sure if it was all about the building for you. I mean, the process. But I thought you would appreciate this. That it would make you happy. I had to make a lot of decisions myself, of course, but I wanted it to be a surprise." "Rodney?" Shepard asked again, a small grin beginning to play over his features. "Oh, hell," said Rodney and waved a hand over the control panel that operated the 2 huge sliding doors. "I finished your plane." And there it was, the beautiful Mustang, glinting silver in the new Lantian sun. Shepard staggered a little and grabbed for something nearby to steady himself, which happened to be Rodney's arm, and they entered the workshop. Well, hangar now, Rodney supposed. Mating the wings was really a two-person job. Ronan helped with that. And the Marines wanted to pitch in, so they made you a runway with that tar from PXN 777. The South Pier was really a good place for your plane. There's so much empty space on this side. Did you think about that before? Rodney said some other things about the propeller and the flap relays, but he could tell he'd lost his audience. Shepard was walking slowly around the plane, looking at it from all angles with an expression of wonder on his face. Rodney, he said slowly, you did this? You hate it. I swear, I'll take it apart. I'll start right now. You can finish building it however you want. Rodney, Shepard said, and now the grin on his face was unmistakable. I don't hate it. Rodney felt his heart pound in his chest. There was such a look of joy on Shepard's face, he almost couldn't stand it. Shepard was here, and he was alive, and that was everything. If nothing ever happened between them more than what they had right now, that was enough. He knew he was grinning back. Then Shepard was suddenly across the room, right next to him, wrapping his arms around Rodney. And they were kissing, and Shepard's tongue was in his mouth, and Rodney's hands were in Shepard's hair, and some part of Rodney was thinking, thank God, thank God. But most of him was just holding on tight. John, with startling originality, named the plane the Spirit of Atlantis. But informally, he called it Bessie for some weird Shepardian reason. Rodney got one of the labs busy making gasoline, and John took the plane up almost every Saturday, more often when he could. Sometimes he even got Rodney to agree to come along. The years off Rodney's life were a fair trade for seeing John so happy up there in the blue sky. John was relaxed and free up there in a way Colonel Shepard never was. He would perform stalls and barrel rolls and threaten to teach Rodney how to fly the airplane, laughing when Rodney went suddenly pale. More than flying with John, though, Rodney loved staying on the ground and watching him up above. John would soar and show off, speeding in circles around the city. He did aerobatics that made Rodney's heart leap into his throat, but they made him happy, and Rodney would never, ever ask him to stop. Rodney was proud of little Bessie, but he still preferred the puddle jumpers by a factor of 10. So he was greatly aggrieved the time all the jumpers went down with a nanite virus, and John had to use the plane to evacuate Jinto and a team of anthropologists back to Atlantis from the mainland after the ruins they were studying collapsed and doctors Reese and Connolly respectively broke a leg and punctured a lung. John only said, I told you so, once, but Rodney caught him fondling Bessie's nose later, when it was all over, and patting her on the wing. The end.